from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, I'll find out about the Society of Indiana Pioneers.
I'll talk with choreographer Cynthia Pratt about the Streamlines Multi-Arts Project.
And I'll learn about the Sightlines Theater Project. It's a lot of lines on our show. But we'll also have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. If your family goes back a few generations in Indiana, or you're just interested in Indiana history, you should know about the Society of Indiana Pioneers. Sharon Gamble invited President Jim Fadley to tell her about the Society's activities honoring the memory and work of the pioneers of Indiana.
The Society of Indiana Pioneers, I want to start with, who are you and what is your mission?
Sure. The Society of Indiana Pioneers is what I would describe as a Hoosier Heritage organization whose mission is to honor the memory and the work of the pioneers of Indiana.
And how do we define pioneers?
So to be a member, you have to have had an ancestor, a pioneer ancestor who came to Indiana before 1840. And you can be a member and associate member if you didn't. So if you love Indiana history, pioneer history, you can be a member.
Mm-hmm.
But we are the descendants of those who came to Indiana prior to 1840, with the exception of about five of the 92 counties in northern Indiana, which were settled later.
Mm-hmm. So, and so for those of us a little bleary on our history, why 1840?
Well, 1840, I think, is generally accepted as the close of the pioneer period in this state. And so we have members, and we have 1,000 members, about half of whom live in Indiana, and about half, 500 or so, who live in other states and abroad, who have a deep love for Indiana.
So wow.
It's a fairly large organization by nonprofit membership organization metrics.
Do most states have something comparable, and are you part of a national?
We are not. We are standalone.
Really?
We are. So, you know, it has a genealogical aspect to it, obviously.
Yeah.
We maintain what is a fantastic, fabulous database of pioneer information in Indiana, open to academics or to anyone who's interested. But we're sort of a state-only, Indiana-only genealogical society. So they're like organizations, but they're not really connected.
Mm-hmm. I know, and you have a little portal on your website where I plugged in some of my ancestors' names just to see if any connection turned up.
Yeah, we have a genealogists on staff who will help people who think they might have a Hoosier pioneer ancestor or who need a little help along the way, you know, what document counts for what or what substantiates a particular generational connection. And we have an office manager. Our office is in the Indiana State Library. So
that seems appropriate.
It is very appropriate. The State Library, you know, is the largest repository of things about Indiana on the planet. And so we have a small office there and a very active board of governors that oversee this organization.
And
we have a lot of fun.
And how old is the organization?
We are celebrating, funny you should ask, we're celebrating our centennial this year. We were founded in 1916. So our centennial clearly coexists with the state's bicentennial.
Right.
And our formation was a result of the Indiana Centennial.
Mm-hmm.
And so John H. Holliday, the owner of the Indianapolis News, was our founder. And he was in charge of the Indiana Centennial Celebration Committee in Indianapolis and Marion County. And it was actually his wife who said, I think there ought to be a heritage organization composed of the descendants of the original settlers or pioneers of Indiana.
And keep that celebration going.
And to keep it going.
Yeah.
And so here we are, 100 years later, with a robust endowment and 1,000-person membership. And people who just have a deep affection for Indiana.
You must have fascinating archives, not just from the state's history, but from the 100-year history of the organization.
We do. It's fun. So anyone interested in early Indiana history, we are a place one should touch base. Not only do we have all of the proofs, the genealogical proofs for the membership, but we publish an annual yearbook, which is chock full of information, helpful information, historic information. And we fund, one of our educational initiatives is to fund graduate fellowships in Pioneer Indiana history at Indiana graduate schools, at the master's thesis level and at the doctoral dissertation level.
Wow.
So we really do try to keep the celebration going.
Wow.
and to keep that research and that academic side going.
Really deepening that scholarship then.
Yeah. And on the other side, in a more popular history way, I guess we have annual pilgrimages, we call them. Hoosier Heritage Pilgrimages. I love that. And we have one in the spring, one in the fall. We have for almost our full 100 years. And so this year, to celebrate our centennial, our organization's centennial, the state's bicentennial, in the spring, we're going to Corydon, where we are going to plant an elm in honor of the constitutional elm on the grounds of the first state capitol.
For anybody who's not familiar with the constitutional elm, tell us about that.
Under which the 1816 Constitution of the state of Indiana was written. And then we are going on to Cedar Farm, owned by the Cook family of Bloomington. The only plantation-style complex in the state, dates back to 1837, and lunch there and tour there. It's on the banks of the Ohio River in Harrison County. And then we're going upriver to Madison and visiting places like the Shrewsbury House, the Wendell Shrewsbury House, a National Historic Landmark. And those of us who belong to this organization love all of those kinds of things.
So, will you be swinging by the Hanover campus since you're
we
close
will
to there?
Be. Yeah. Yes, we'll do a little... as a proud Hanover alumnus, I wanted to make sure we did that.
And people can come on the pilgrimage if they are members of any category, full members, associate members, or how does that work?
Membership members have priority,
mm-hmm.
and then you can
sure.
be an associate member if you don't have lineage back to the original pioneers. And then members can bring guests. The spring pilgrimage is sold out at this point.
Oh, my gosh. Great. Good for you.
It's going to really be a singular kind of experience. And then in the fall, in September, we will go to the Lincoln Boyhood Memorial, to New Harmony, do overnight at New Harmony, and they go up to Vincennes and have a beautiful sort of drinks and hors d'oeuvres event in Grouseland, William Henry Harrison's 1803-04 home in
wow.
Vincennes. And that trip is wide open at this point.
These all seem very appropriate for the bicentennial year as well as your
yes.
own centennial.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you raise the money for the fellowships that you described a minute ago?
Well, happily, about 20 years ago, I guess it is now, the Board of Governors had the foresight to establish an endowment to sustain this organization into the future and see that it's a viable organization down the road. And so we're very healthy, I'm happy to say, in being able to support the activities of the organization, including the graduate fellowships at the master's and doctoral levels.
You're also having a centennial black tie celebration. Is that a fundraiser as well?
We are. Well, it's not a fundraiser, but it's our centennial, our organizational centennial gala, and also to honor the state's bicentennial. And it's on Monday, June 27th at Connor Prairie. It's black tie optional. And we're really looking forward to that. We're partnering with the Friends of the Indiana Archives. And we are honoring the descendants of the 43 signers of the 1816 Constitution of the state. And so the Indiana Archives, they have identified all the grave sites of the 43 signers. So they'll be having ceremonies at each one. And then descendants of those 43 signers will be in town or in the state. And so we're inviting them, as well as the Friends of the Archives. And then among our membership in the Society of Indiana Pioneers, we have 8 people who are descendants of those 43 signers.
What? That's so beautiful,
so
the idea of this commemoration.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fun. Connor Prairie is closed on Monday, so it'll be available fully to our organization, and it should be a special moment in our 100-year history and a lot of fun.
How did you have you always been interested in the genealogy of your own background, or how did you come to that? Did you wake up one day and say, I want to know where my forebears came from?
I have always loved history, so it's a natural, you know, just a natural thing for me and has always been. So I was a history major in undergrad and graduate work and taught history and been in love with history and particularly in love with Indiana, its history. All my life.
And where did the Fadleys come from when they came to Indiana?
Well, the Fadleys came from the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. Oh. And my high school in Henry County is Shenandoah High School because many other families in the area in northwestern Henry County came here from the Shenandoah Valley. So we came here in 1837. So my children are seven generations deep in Indiana.
Wow. I love that.
Yeah, it's fun.
Tell me something that would surprise people about members of Society of Indiana Pioneers.
Well, I just researched what I would call, I suppose, prominent members of the Society of Indiana Pioneers. So there's an interesting list of people who have been involved with this organization, and it ranges from Mrs. Henry Schricker, who was Governor Schricker's wife, who was very active, to Eli Lilly, the last Eli Lilly, and J.K. Lilly Sr., his father, were on our board of governors and served this organization. The president of Wabash College was a member of the organization. Prosecutors who have prosecuted infamous cases here in Indianapolis, in any case. So I think the diversity of people, and not just people of prominence, but the diversity of the membership. So we have anyone and everyone who's deeply rooted in this state, who cares about the history of this state and wants to keep that celebration and that commemoration going, they're members. So it's a really diverse membership.
Including a lot of interesting women, right?
There are, yeah. Yeah.
Because Pioneer, lots of times people just picture a very manly man going across the across the wilderness.
Yeah. No, that's right. There have been interesting women who have been involved with the organization over time. Maxine Brown in Corydon is just a fun and very interesting woman who's very proud of her history. She's African-American, lives in Corydon, and really has helped us expand the recognition of African-American history in Indiana as it's uncovered and celebrated. And so that continues, including Native American history. And so one of our members is descended from original French settlers in Vincennes, and his ancestry dates back, you know, to Vincennes settled in 1732. And his ancestor, I believe, was there in that year or just about that year. And so when we got together, the stories are fun, many tales.
Yeah, and room to still find lots more people to broaden the membership, which is a great position to be in 100 years.
Absolutely. We would love to see our 1,000 membership number increase to 1,500 over the coming decade. And I think that's possible as we let people know who we are, that we're there, and the activities we engage in.
Stay tuned. We'll tell you how to find out more.
Sharon Gamble with Society of Indiana Pioneers President Jim Fadley. An Indiana pioneer is one who lived within the present boundary of an Indiana county on or before December 31st, 1840. And if you're descended from a pioneer, you're eligible for membership in the society. But don't worry, you can still be an associate member if you're interested in this era of early state history, but don't have the qualifying forebears. You can learn lots more about the Society of Indiana Pioneers by visiting indianapioneers.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Cynthia Pratt is a professor of dance at Butler University, and recently she choreographed an interpretive dance called River Run that brings to life scientific concepts and concerns about human intervention of Indy's waterways. The dance was originally performed live in September 2015 at Holcomb Gardens, and the Butler Ballet staged it recently at their Midwinter Dance Festival. Now River Run will become a film installation as part of Butler's Arts Fest. Travis DiNicola spoke with Cynthia as well as Butler junior dancer Nick Nelson about this work.
Cynthia and Nick, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having
us. It's great to be here.
You're very welcome. Cynthia, let's start with you on this, because this piece, River Run, has gone through a lot of iterations, we could say, and we'll then be talking about all that. But it's all part of a larger project that sort of connects art and science and Indiana's waterways through something called Streamlines. How did you get involved with this, or what exactly sort of is this Streamlines?
Well, Streamlines is a project that's funded by the National Science Foundation, and the object is to fuse the arts and sciences together to make to invigorate a curiosity about our waterways here in Indianapolis. So the idea is to sort of use the arts to hook people in to be more involved and take more ownership for their environment, particularly the waterways.
It's a really cool project. And we've talked about this before on Art of the Matter with Mark Kiesling and some other people as well. How did you get connected to it?
Well, at the time, the grant was formulated by Tim Carter, who was the director of the Butler Center for Urban Ecology. And he just came over to the dance program and said, who here is interested in a project that is using dance to convey some scientific concepts? And that was really right up my alley.
And you're like, yes, me.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And so tell me about the original piece, because that was actually presented last September, I believe.
That's right. That piece was the first incarnation of River Run. And that was a site-specific piece done in Holcomb Gardens on Butler University's campus. It had all of the members of the Butler Ballet, mm-hmm. which were over 100 dancers. And we used a lot of imagery to convey characteristics of the waterways, as well as try and illustrate some scientific concepts that are of concern to the waterways.
How do you do that in dance?
Well, say we're working with the whole idea of one of the concepts I was working with was the idea of invasive species taking over mm-hmm. the ecosystem. So I had groups of dancers, and they're moving in sort of harmonious ways, sort of individually to represent the diversity of species. And then I had another group of dancers, after that, the first groups had been established with their movement, another group that was moving with sort of a different kind of, disharmonious, kind of aggressive mm-hmm. movements. And as they moved into the space, then the dancers who were part of the ecosystem group, they became one with this other, showing that the diversity was sort of flattened out into this one species taken over.
That's really cool. I can totally picture that.
Oh, good, good. Yeah.
Nick, you were part of that, correct?
Yes, I've been part of all of the Streamlines projects so far. And the first one, I think, was definitely the most special just because it was done outside, and it was interesting because it was like the light was perfect. Like it was at 4 p.m. and the sun was like kind of, you know, low in the sky, and mm-hmm. you really got to feel like you were, you know, becoming the stream. A lot of it was like we were the stream, and then we were the animals going through the stream. And it's different. Like, I mean, when you're a dancer in a studio, you feel like you're always kind of dancing in a box, and then you mm-hmm. get on stage and then you feel like you're being presented. But really to go outside and like be in the environment that, you know, it's just a very different environment than I'm used to dancing in. It really allowed,
I mean, obviously,
you know,
perfect for this choreography.
Of course.
But, I mean, but still, I mean, it sounds like even beyond that.
It really allowed you to, like, I felt like kind of I felt like transcended a little bit into mm-hmm. something else. And there was a lot of really great energy with the crowd, because the piece actually invited us to move throughout the gardens, and there were several different spots, and we would run past them and like the stream taking, you know, picking things up, and they would kind of run with us. And it was a very special experience, because we had all of these kind of like ambitious ideas about what we, you know, would want to do with the work and how we would want it to happen. And, you know, we kind of just said, let's go for it. And it happened.
It sounds, Cynthia, like the students were a big part of the creation of this.
Absolutely. It definitely was a collaboration. The students came up with a lot of the movement. I would give a task. I might say, okay, let's have three people go out and form a landscape, and then let's have four more people go and join them in where you think that the landscape should be. And I would describe the landscape of the waterways. For example, Pleasant Run Creek is very rocky, and it's got a lot of jagged edges. And so they would work with those kinds of shapes in their own bodies. And then you have Pogue's Run Creek, which runs underneath the city, and the city has been built on top of it. So I would give an improvisational task of some of the dancers being the stream and then some of the dancers finding ways to cover up the stream.
Very cool. So then this piece that was very site-specific was taken inside, right, as part of the Midwinter Dance Festival?
Yes. Then we did it in a more traditional theatrical form, which was a dance piece with a proscenium stage. And those who had not seen the launch really seemed to respond well to that piece. And those who had seen the launch said, I like the launch better.
Well, that happens.
Well, I mean, because it really was. I mean, Nick has described it perfectly. The launch was, you know, it's really, for many people who haven't seen much dance, to be that close up with it. And, you know, it was the site-specific work was more of an installation where you moved from area to area. And so along the way, and the dancers did change areas, and onlookers mentioned that they really, when they felt the dancers sweep by, they could feel the wind coming from their, you know, from the path, and they felt more involved in it. So it did have an audience participation component in it.
But it sounds like it was also still successful on stage as
well. I think I was very happy with it.
But just a different type of piece.
Very different type of piece, yes. And but I was very happy with the outcome, and it was, I think, very well received.
And Nick, you were part of that as well?
Yes, I was. And I think probably one of the more interesting parts about that is a lot of the choreography that we had originally done was taken and then modified for the stage. And we were able to actually solidify a lot more technical and develop a lot of the more dance parts of it, more so than we could outside. Because when you're working outside and working in grass, you only have, you know, there's only so much you can do and you're limited by the movement. Not to say that it wasn't successful, but
it's different. It changes things.
Yes, but having it, you know, the same kind of movement being taken to the stage allowed us to really develop the technical side of it. So I think it's very, very completely different things, and but it's very exciting that, you know, is able to be done in both mediums.
And now it's becoming a film, right? Sort of this immersive 360 film, am I getting this right?
Yes.
So how does that all work as part of this big tent project?
Well, I had a filmmaker come and film the launch, and she did it from some really interesting angles. And then we got together and edited the film of the launch, and which was the site-specific piece. It kicked off the Streamlines season. And we edited this film to go inside of a venue called Big Tent, which is an 8-screen, 360-degree immersive theater. And so you walk inside, and the dance is going on all around you. And so you have this submersive experience, which is quite different from the site-specific work and quite different from the proscenium stage work.
Yeah, sure.
And yet is the same piece.
Now, when you were working, were you involved, Cynthia, with the editing of that? Okay. So,
yes.
I mean, I was also wondering, you know, did you choreograph thinking about how that was going to translate onto film in this third version?
I did not think about when I did the original choreography, but editing the film was like a dance, choreographing a dance in itself.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah.
So 8 screens, and I know this is going to be in Lilly Hall as part of the Butler Arts Fest coming up.
Yes, on the 9th, 8th, April 9th and 10th.
Very cool. So Nick, so your role in this?
Well,
you get to be on screen.
I'm actually in the film. I haven't seen the film yet, so I'm excited to actually finally see it. But yeah, I'm in the film.
That's going to be a neat experience.
It will be neat, and it's really cool that.
I'm sure you've seen yourself like on video, you know, in performances.
Yes,
but this will be completely.
I mean, it'll be me, but like then I'll run behind myself, and then I'll run above myself. So it'll be cool to see it in that. Light.
Yeah, it was a really good experience for the dancers to be filmed because they're used to being on stage, but they don't realize when they're being filmed outside that they have to, like, we would have a shot when we were editing the film, we would see something that looked just fabulous, and then we would see a dancer scratch her arm or something, and well, we couldn't use that. So they're just not used to having to hold something where there's not an audience. Mm-hmm.
The commitment for that type of work is so much more. So, I mean, not that you shouldn't be committed in your other dance work, but we had to be completely conscious of every single movement because you can't have it show up on film because film is forever.
Right, right. Well, what a great experience. I mean, it sounds like for a number of reasons. I mean, Cynthia, for your students, but also as a choreographer, to take this piece through these three different versions and be able to keep sort of presenting it and rethinking it and expanding upon it.
Oh, you know, it's been such a privilege to work on this project. In many ways. First of all, the whole idea behind trying to raise awareness about our waterways and about our environment. You know, I had no idea before I went into this project any of the concerns that we had here on our waterways. You know, I mean, to me, the White River was just something to take a bridge over, and you know, and the canal was just something I walked along in a nice pastoral setting there. And now I realize that we have such a tremendous impact on these waterways, and that they are beautiful, and they have a personal meaning for me. And to be able to choreograph dance around those ideas and hopefully have someone take that away, to communicate that and have them take that away with them is really an honor.
Nick, how about for you, not just as a dancer, but as a student?
Definitely as a student, this is something that, well, first off, I didn't know until this summer that was really going to be happening, or like the details of what it was going to be. But having such a unique and I really connected and really important experience like this, just because the state of our, you know, ecosystem is very, you know, very much deteriorating these days. But to be a part of something so large and to know that, like, what we're doing as dancers can actually communicate a message, it gives me a lot of validity. And it just being one, you know, little guy out of 100 people and being able to be a part of that makes me think more so of the whole project and the whole world. So
it sounds like an awesome experience.
It really is.
Yeah, congratulations on that. It sounds like it'll be a lot of fun to see this in the big tent as a film. Cynthia, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Travesty Nicola with Cynthia Pratt, professor of dance at Butler, and Butler junior and dancer Nick Nelson. River Run Dance will be recreated as a film installation as part of Butler's Arts Fest, running all day on April 9th and 10th in Studio 310 in Lilly Hall. There will also be live music, readings, and other activities within the Big Tent venue. And meanwhile, the music of Streamlines, curated by Michael Kaufman, is available at streamlines.org. Also in April, the poetry of Streamlines will be featured all month in the Arts Garden. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
May I hear your best lion impersonation?
Oh, it's that time again.
It is.
Oh, I'm so excited. Oh. Maybe that's not it. Definitely. You know what? My lion got cut short by my groundhog.
I'm so confused. Well, here's March, and whether you believe it's coming in like a lion or going out like
a
lamb,
let's hope so.
It's time for some March events on our calendar we call
What'll
We
Do? Well, I tell you what I'm doing this weekend. I am very excited about going to see Christian Scott at the Jazz Kitchen, also known as Christian Scott Atunde Adua, and he is an incredible trumpeter and composer from New Orleans, from a great New Orleans jazz family, his uncle, his dad, a whole bunch of other people. But he's really made a name for himself over the past 10, 15 years or so, and some great critically acclaimed albums and really interesting music, and just a great, great jazz musician coming to Jazz Kitchen this weekend. Show is at 7 p.m.
Fantastic. Also on the music front, this Sunday afternoon, the American Pianists Association is presenting classical pianist Eric Liu at Butler University's Eisenduckwall Recital Hall at 3:30. On the program, music of Mozart, Schumann, Schubert, and Chopin. Lots of great romantic music, romantic and classical music this weekend. Learn more at AmericanPianists.org.
Very cool. Sharon, I think you'll like this.
What is it?
Paint your pet. Yes, painting your pet. It's a paint your pet event at Sugar Creek Art Center, which is in Thorntown in Boone County. A great art center that's located up there. And you can join Miss Kate this Sunday for a paint your pet event starring your favorite cat or dog. Don't actually bring your cat
or
dog.
Put your pet carrier away.
Bring a photo of your pet to the class and let Miss Kate help you capture your pet in some bright acrylic paint on canvas. You're not actually going to paint on your pet. You're painting on the canvas.
Thank goodness.
You're making a fun portrait of your pet. I think it sounds like a great idea. Paint your pet.
Do you have a photo with all of your pets in one photo?
We have not been able to achieve that yet.
You need a panoramic lens.
Telephoto, panoramic, all of them at the same time. Yeah. Anyway, but that's from 1 to 3, ages 5 and up. But a fun thing for adults at Sugar Creek Art Center in Thorntown.
That actually sounds like a lovely event.
Yeah.
And family-friendly, too. That's groovy. Mm-hmm. If you're up for a bit of a road trip?
It could be.
It could be a road trip, but I'm thinking more it should be a road trip. This weekend, you might want to head to the IU Art Museum Special Exhibitions Gallery because this Saturday they are opening a new exhibit called Arts of Kenya, Beauty and Traditional Forms. And the title kind of tells you what you're going to see. Included will be colorful jewelry, elegant yet simple containers, a masterfully crafted headrest, stools, walking sticks, and other personal items, and as they say, many, many more from the traditional visual art world of Kenya. You can find out at more at artmuseum.indiana.edu, artmuseum.indiana.edu. But again, that exhibit opens this Saturday and runs through May 8th.
That sounds very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, this sounds like a lot of fun. This Saturday, 7:30 p.m., Modus Dance up at their space at 40th and Pennsylvania. They are doing Hourglass. It's a live music and dance improvisation community event. You can be a part of it. If you love live music and you find that inspires you and makes you want to move, then you can be a part of this. And if you just want to come and watch and listen and observe, you can do that too. It's immersive music and video and movement. 60 minutes of a continuous arc of fully composed music by Robin Cox. And instruction will be given. Stephanie Nugent will be guiding it. Everyone is welcome to come and be a part of it. It sounds really cool. Robin Cox will be there playing violin. And also Sean Goodman, who we've had on Our The Matter before. She'll be playing her bass clarinet. And will be a part of it as well that Modus is doing on Saturday.
Fun. Hey, we would be remiss if we didn't remind you to be by your television set this Sunday night for our sister station, WFYI TV 20, for Get Out the White Hankies Now and Weep, the finale, the final, final episode of Downton Abbey. Oh,
Sharon, what plot will you do?
Plot lines get all tied up.
What will you
up
do with your Sunday nights
I will watch Mr. Selfridge, the final season of Mr. Selfridge, but that's another story for another time.
Very good. Hey, an opening that's taking place on Friday night the 4th, and the show will be running through the 25th. At Gallery 924, that's the Arts Council's gallery, is Owens and Crowley. Everything is sacred, nothing is sacred, and other modern allegories. I'm really excited about this show. It features the artist team of Quincy Owens and Luke Crowley, who have done some work before. We've had them here on Art of the Matter as well. They've done some really interesting work. Quincy is an artist and art teacher. Crowley's a science teacher and an engineer, and they've been doing some very cool projects together, and they are doing a installation again called Everything is Sacred, Nothing is Sacred at Gallery 924 That's the Arts Council's gallery, opening Friday the 4th, running through the 25th.
If you're hearing us on Friday night, I have two Friday night art events for you. The Indiana Music and Entertainment Museum announces the opening of its new gallery space at Wheeler Arts in Fountain Square, and it's going to hold its first open house this first Friday from 7 to 10, featured a rare artifacts, posters, and collectibles from Indiana Music, Film, and Broadcasting, and this will also, if you aren't familiar with them, give you a chance to learn more about their mission. They're also accepting donations not only of cash, but also of historical music, film, and broadcasting artifacts. And there will be music and refreshments at that first Friday event, again, at the Wheeler Arts Building in Fountain Square this Friday. Also, Rad Drew, who specializes in iPhone photography.
Yeah, some very cool stuff.
Yeah, very cool stuff. And he has a show featuring people and places of Cuba in his First Friday Gallery show this Friday at Indiana Landmark Center in the Rapp Family Gallery. And a lot of these are very candid photos picturing the private side of Cuban life. And as he says, some of them reflect the oppression endured by the Cuban people, but they're just stellar and stunning. So that's this Friday, 6 to 9 at Indiana Landmark Center.
Sounds great. Hey, Sharon, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis' Indie Arts Guide website, or just listen to us next week on that calendar we call
What Do We Do? Bah.
Bah.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Sightlines Theater is a new enterprise by Lou Harry and John Thomas. Sharon Gamble invited them in to tell her about their site-specific theater plans.
All right. This is not the first time you two have cooked up theater adventures together. How did this idea come about?
Well, a lot of ideas come about in the course of lunch conversations, and if we keep to a good percentage, only the good ones come out. So this was one of the better ones.
But that makes me want to know what's left on the cutting room floor.
We're going to start charging for lunches with us for that reason. Now, we've been, you know, and Lou has done a great job of thinking, how can we get theater outside the theater? And this is just grew from those conversations. What can we do a little differently? And we love to showcase the good writing and to make sure that people are getting to see theater in different settings, if possible.
Why is it important to get outside of a traditional theater?
Well, because I think there are very smart, interested, possibly engaged audiences out there that aren't necessarily, you know, their playbook doesn't include, hey, I think I'm going to go to the theater this weekend. Sometimes they need some doors and windows opened for them.
Hmm.
So the premise that we came up with, we also, parallel to that, also really love play readings.
Mm-hmm.
And think the play readings, they're not the kind of architectural plans for a play. A play reading in and of itself can be a wonderful arts experience. Your good ones I've been to, I'm always amazed at how much I am caught up in the story and the characters. And certain plays play better in play readings sometimes. It becomes theater of the mind.
But it's another way of lowering the barrier to entry.
Yes.
You know, if you tell people we're going to do a reading, sometimes I think they're a little less intimidated maybe.
Right.
At the risk of sounding really simplistic here, describe what a play reading is.
Okay. At a play reading, an audience is there. Professional actors are there. They have scripts in hand, and they've rehearsed the play. But there aren't sets. There aren't costumes. There's somebody on stage reading the stage directions, enough to tell you where we are, what's going on.
Suddenly the door opens.
The door opens.
Yeah. And actors are generally not moving.
Right, and you get a full play. Often they're seated and then standing up when they're in a scene, so you have those visual cues of who you're seeing at a given time. There are other theaters elsewhere. I'm a big fan of a group called LA Theater Works,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen a lot of their work. Anytime I go out to Los Angeles, I try to go see their work. They use terrific actors who often are might not be available for a six-month run of a play or 4 weeks of rehearsal and 5 weeks of a play because of TV and movie commitments and
sure.
things like that. But they are available for a week to rehearse and do a three-performance reading of a play. So I've seen actors like Eric Stoltz, Elliot Gould, Jamie Lee Curtis, Joe Beth Williams, just wonderful actors in play readings out in L.A. And they have a series that's been running forever, and you can get lots of their tapes at the library. Mm-hmm. I strongly recommend you do that. That helped inspire us to do something like this.
It is kind of funny, and you said it without a trace of irony, that you, when you're in L.A., you go to see mm-hmm. a reading, not a fully staged. And I know you exactly. see fully staged plays as well.
But there, I know the quality is going to be there.
Sure.
And I love hearing. They also pick a certain, what's a kind of play, because they're not all one kind of play. But there are certain plays that play better in readings. And one of the things we look for in this for this series are plays that really engage in character and story. They don't have a whole lot of things that a theater director would say, we can put all kinds of bells and whistles on here, and we're going to jump around in time, and the set's going to change to this, and that's going to be what wows. There's wonderful theater that can do that, and we love that other theater does it. This, we want to reach people by telling them a really strong, character-driven story. And we're not just, let's find a play that we like, but the goal of this is to find groups that already exist out there, that are part of a constituency because of an interest group, because of a passion, because of a location, and bring a play to them that we think would work for them.
So you, in your brainstorming, have probably come up with some sites
yes.
without mm-hmm. the lines yet, without the you know, some right. places you'd like to hold a reading without a play necessarily that fits
right.
it yet.
And it's a place plus a group. That's the thing. There are wonderful locations that we'd love to take theater. But we also want to find that, know that that audience is already out there that has an interest in a certain area. I mean, we've talked, our fantasy list, none of these are committed, but we would love to do a play. There's a wonderful play called Mr. Ricky Calls a Meeting about Jackie Robinson that we would love to do, like, in the locker room at Victory Field.
Oh, wow.
We'd love to do a play in the woods at Connor Prairie, maybe something at Crown Hill Cemetery. There's so many cool locations that have people who are already interested in that place, that subject. So we would get the theater fans into the baseball stadium and the baseball fans to hear
and
a play that's about what they're interested
yeah,
in.
Yeah, yeah.
There's hospitals we'd love to perform in.
Uh-huh.
There are, you know, a law school. There's some wonderful legal plays out
Medical
there.
Medical History Museum.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, we've talked about a lot of those things. And again, the idea being that there are people who will go to those places that would not go into a theater. So let's take the theater to them and make it a very comfortable experience and engage them.
And show them the quality of the actors that we have available here. One of the things that we always do at a reading is have the actors let the audience know where else they can be seen. What do they have coming up at the Phoenix, at Theater on the Square, at the IRT, at Actors Theater, wherever else they're performing.
So
and we also want to create
sneakily luring people
oh, sure.
into traditional theater.
Absolutely.
Good for
you. Horribly sneaky people.
Right. Yeah, and we want to create opportunity, professional opportunities for actors here. Now, we're mm-hmm. not making anyone rich, but all of our actors are paid for these performances.
Tell us about your December production at Gallery 924 was your first production of Sightlines, right?
Yes, it was a play called The Credot Canvas by Keith Bunin. And it was a show that looked at the what does it mean to be an artist, for one thing, and how close does art come to, how does imitation in art come to forgery in art?
Oh.
And so there was a wonderful discussion afterwards with some artists who came to the show who wanted to talk about art, but also loved to hear about how the actors felt about it. And that's a great part of the conversation.
And that conversation is a big part of it. We always have something before a show. In that case, a chance to see the work in the gallery by local artists, and a conversation after. Shannon Linker from the Arts Council, and who runs Gallery 924, led a discussion about authenticity in art and issues raised by the play. And this was a play that has never been done in Indianapolis. It was done off-Broadway. It's been done in some other cities. So we also look for plays that aren't, we don't want to compete with the existing theaters. We want to provide one-night experiences that augment that.
At that performance, was this on a night the gallery was just open, or was it closed so that you had a little, so that you didn't have people just popping in to see the exhibit in the middle of the reading.
It was technically an evening that the gallery was closed, right. But it was interesting because people walking by in the street could see something going on. So if someone had decided just to walk in and pop in, we would have been happy to have them come in and join us midway. We're all of our projects are very casual that way.
Yeah.
But, in that case, it was closed, but it's free. And
that one was free and the doors were open. So,
yeah.
And we got a lively crowd that wanted to talk and engage long after the reading was over.
You have another production. I shouldn't call it a production. You have another reading coming up.
It is a production in a sense. It's not a full, again, not sets, costumes, and all that,
sure.
But we treat it as a full professional production.
Yeah, okay. That, you have another one coming up that centers on buildings?
On Frank Lloyd Wright, actually. We're partnering with Historic Landmarks.
Indiana Landmarks.
Indiana Landmarks. Get their old name in there. They'll be mad at me for that.
Yes, we will.
Yeah.
With my other hat on.
Yeah, that's right. On a show about Frank Lloyd Wright, and obviously so many people are fascinated with him, and what you tend to learn about Frank Lloyd Wright as you learn more about him was that he could be quite a character, and I think jerk is the word that comes
kind.
Up.
That was kind.
But this play takes place at a moment in his life when he has decided to make a big change to try to reinvigorate his career. And he has gone to California, and coincident with this, he has just gotten word or is getting word in the course of this play that it seems that the hotel that he just built in Japan to great acclaim was destroyed by an earthquake.
The one that he claimed was indestructible.
Oh.
Right. And so there is a period of time during the play where you don't know what's come of this hotel exactly. So that is hanging in the balance. His relationship with his children is hanging in the balance. And his other relationships.
Yeah.
It's
this
fascinating.
This is about the time he's leaving his first wife?
Yep. Oh, that the divorce is pending.
Okay.
And it's a... You know, to maybe trivialize a little bit, it's a guy who's really good at making houses, but not really good at making homes.
Mm.
And Richard Nelson, who's a wonderful playwright, has created a really interesting moment for these characters. And I think that people, knowing nothing about Wright, will really engage with it because it also gets... It gets its hands around the challenges of creating something that you then have to hand off to other people to build, and what that does to an artistic sensibility. So, so I think the architects who show up, the preservationists who show up, people already interested in this will be just as engaged.
And for those of you Wright fans who are out there yelling back at the radio, there are no Wright houses or buildings in Indianapolis.
This is true. And obviously that was our first goal when we first talked about this. Let's find a home that is as close to Wright as we can find around here. And there were a couple of options, but none of them that could really take a crowd, so to speak.
Yeah.
So let's go into a wonderful building right here that can accommodate a play like this, a play that's in a place that's clearly about, you know, walls.
Place and architecture.
And all that, and engage in that way.
And architectural ambition.
Absolutely.
For that matter.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Tell us about the cast.
The cast. We are 90% there in terms of our casting. Some terrific actors who you will have seen on area stages. If you've seen the shows that Bob Harbin has directed elsewhere, Harbin's going to be playing Louis Sullivan.
Oh.
In this, our own John Thomas is going to be playing Frank Lloyd Wright.
I can see it.
Yeah. Georgiana Smith, formerly of No Exit Performance, is going to be playing one of the children. Clay Mabbitt, who's also you've seen at Theater on the Square and elsewhere, is going to be in there. And we are building the rest of this cast. We're very excited about those who have joined up. Erica Barker, who's currently in Impressionism at Wisdom Tooth, has just joined us. The actors are excited about it because it's a chance for them to really get their teeth around good parts and not have to memorize scripts.
Exactly. Or commit weeks of their lives.
Right.
Stay tuned. We're going to tell you how to get more information. But I want to ask you, so if somebody is hearing this and is thinking, well, I have a suggestion, either for a play or a space or a constituency, an audience.
We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear from audience people who say, hey, I have this group. Find a great play for us. That's the first group of people we want to hear from. Or, you know, if people want to sponsor the entire series, those are welcome as well.
Welcome to the not-for-profit world of arts, right?
Right. Right. And, you know, and it is challenging. We aren't necessarily excited if folks say, I've always loved play X because I've seen it 20 times and I want to hear another reading of it. That's not what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. We want to bring, as Lou said, these are plays that have never been performed in Indianapolis, relatively contemporary plays, to say the least. And we really want to, that's another part of it, is to bring new scripts to light.
Ones that have a track record. They've all been professionally produced elsewhere, so we're also not a new script workshop. By any stretch, the audiences will be getting polished, established plays.
Right, but feed those ideas to us. We will have a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/sightlinesindie. Just love to hear from folks who have ideas.
Sharon Gamble with Lou Harry and John Thomas. Their new endeavor is Sightlines Theater. That's Sight, S-I-T-E, Lines, Sightlines. And their next reading is Frank's Home, a play about Frank Lloyd Wright at a crossroads in his personal life and career. The reading is on Wednesday, March 23rd at 6 o'clock, with a short discussion following. Tickets are available at frankshome.eventbrite.com, and you can learn more about future readings by searching Sightlines, again, S-I-T-E, Sightlines Indie, on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when, in anticipation of the first Indianapolis showing of her Art Prize-winning work, Intersections, I'll revisit my extended interview with artist Anila Aga.
I can't wait both to hear your interview again
and to see
the piece.
At the State Museum.
At the State Museum. It's exciting. Also, I'll find out about a world premiere setting of Mansfield Park that the Indianapolis Opera has planned for this spring. And we'll have that arts calendar we call What Do We Do?
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.